Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
House Democrats introduce a bill to ban federal officials from trading or holding individual stocks. But is this overkill, and would it deter good candidates for office or political appointees? Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial board member Mene Ukwe-Barua. Welcome and happy Friday to you both. So this is a bill that has been promised for a little while now. There was a bit of a panic about congressional stock trading, particularly in early 2020, during the beginnings of the pandemic, the COVID crash. And now here we have a bill from House Democrats. Let's listen to Congressman Pete Aguilar, vice chair of the House Democratic Caucus, on why he thinks this bill is worth passing.
I've heard from members who aren't supportive of the bill. It's a thin margin. Whether members would vote against the bill is a separate conversation. They're going through the bill. The final bill text was just released recently. We marked it up, or we had a conversation about it, a hearing about it in House Administration, talking about qualified blind trust, talking about applicability. We've had some members have had more conversations about it. Some members have specific questions. Members are going through this and they're going to make their own decisions.
Kim, what's your read of this question? I mean, one of the things that strikes me just going through the bill that the House Democrats have released is how exceptionally broad it is. This qualified blind trust issue would apply to members of Congress, their spouses, their dependent children, senior aides on Capitol Hill, the president, the vice president, Federal Reserve officials, federal judges, and also presidential political appointees if they need Senate confirmation, which I think includes something like 1,200 people in the bureaucracy.
Yeah, Federal Reserve governors too, regional bank presidents, judges, as you said. It's very, very sweeping. And just to be clear, to go through exactly what it would do, you would still be allowed, for instance, to be invested in a diversified mutual fund. You would be allowed to be invested in a diversified exchange-traded fund. If you had a small business, although this is very vague what the contours of this would be, like a family-run small business, you could still keep an interest in that. I guess there would be somebody who made a decision about that. But if you want to be invested in individual stocks, they have to be in a qualified blind trust or you would have to sell them. So it's not just sweeping in terms of who it would apply to, but sweeping in terms of its prohibition against engaging in any stock trading. And I have a couple real problems with this. One, I'm struggling to see the actual problem that this is meant to address. And we can kind of go through some of the accusations, but there isn't really a lot of there. And the big problem I have is that we want people from all walks of life coming into Congress, people who are doctors or businessmen who bring their expertise and knowledge. It's already very financially punishing to many people to make the decision to run for office because they're giving up jobs where they might otherwise be making millions. And so we don't want to discourage people from doing that. And this would just be another discouragement of good people.
Well, I'll play devil's advocate a bit because I see where some of the critics of congressional stock trading are coming from. And they think that it's a public perception problem, at the very least, when people in these high government positions are trading shares that they may have information on that the public doesn't. They may be closer to these issues. But a few things that I would point out is that, first of all, any trades by members of Congress over $1,000 are already supposed to be publicly reported. So constituents and members of the press can go through those and point out if they think there are conflicts. Number two is that insider information is already barred from congressional trading under the 2012 Stock Act. So a lot of what the critics are worried about is already illegal. And granted, there could be issues with the reporting rules, whether the penalties for breaking the rules are strong enough, and so forth. And I'm not against strengthening those if they need to be strengthened. But number three, a lot of the things that get complained about, I think really just don't hold up. So in 2020, there were criticisms of many senators, congressmen who sold stocks amid the pandemic. Granted, a lot of the public was selling stocks in the middle of the pandemic. There was a reason that the market sort of crashed there for a little while, but as many of them had pretty reasonable explanations. So Dianne Feinstein said that her assets already were in a blind trust. Senator James Inhofe in Oklahoma said that he had asked his investment advisors to divest from stocks, and the investment advisors had been slowly doing that over the course of several years without his involvement. And then some of the headlines that you see where people are getting dinged for conflict of interest, it just doesn't hold up. So there's a Minnesota Democrat named Angie Craig, and apparently her college-age son was trading Lyft and Ford stocks without her knowledge, and she was sitting on the Transportation Committee, and she put forth this great statement. She said, "As a mom, I would be grateful if my college student son was not allowed to own or trade stocks. As a member of Congress, I'm working to pass a law to force him to listen to his mother," unquote. And so, Monet, a bit of humor there, but I have a hard time thinking that some college-age son trading Lyft and losing money on it, apparently, by the way, is a real threat to the Republic.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, to start from the end, I would say that, yes, each individual trade that's being made with information that might be acquired through what the public would consider to be somewhat questionable means or advantageous means is not going to have much of an impact. But I do think that the general principle, the idea that people who are privy to information that isn't public should not be able to trade based on that information or should have pretty strict constraints governing how they go about making trades of that kind, is an important principle. And in the aggregate, theoretically, it does have an impact. And so I am sympathetic to the intention of this bill that's being introduced, the intention being to prohibit members of Congress from gaining on private information that they are accessing because of the position that they've entered as public representatives. What I will say, and I'm glad that you jumped in to kind of play the devil's advocate before, is that I do believe that the 2012 Stock Act already achieves that intention. It specifically prohibits members of Congress, and I believe certain other public officials, from trading based on insider information. And so I think the reason that we're back here having this conversation again is because during the beginning of COVID, you did have a lot of public officials making fairly major trades, and it was alleged that this was based on information that they were getting from researchers about how severe the pandemic would be, what industries it might affect. And I don't believe that those members of Congress were ever disciplined or were ever held accountable for some of those trades. Now, if you look at the details, I think that many of them could probably make a strong case that there were coincidences, maybe that they weren't even in charge of making the trades and things like that. And you could very well say that they were not necessarily guilty of violating the Stock Act in letter of that law. But still, I think the intention of saying that these people should not be trading based on private information is a good intention. If people want to, as you said, revisit the provisions of that law and perhaps tighten the scrutiny and things like that, I think that that should be on the table. And I understand the downside of it, that people don't want to be constrained in their ability to trade and their ability to profit and don't want to check that at the door when they enter Congress. But I do think that there should be some kind of bright line drawn between what constitutes real material non-public information, and it is in the interest of the public to make sure that people aren't trading based on information that really is non-public.
But I guess what I'm getting at is that a lot of the coverage of this issue seems to me pretty cherry-picked, because there are 535 members of Congress, and some of them are trading relatively actively. And so it's pretty easy, I think, to go into a haystack that size and find something that can be made to look really suspicious and write a headline that says Congressman so-and-so is under fire for their stock trading activity. And the study that I keep coming back to is by a bunch of Dartmouth academics, and it came out in 2020 by the National Bureau of Economic Research. And the headline is "Senators as Feckless as the Rest of Us at Stock Picking." And it looks at trading data by the U.S. Senate back to 2012 and basically finds that senators are not able to beat the market. And they contrast that with some of the research before the Stock Act was passed, which showed that the prominent politicians were beating the market. And so, Kim, to Monet's point here, I mean, it looks to me, looking at this study, that the Stock Act really took care of the problem, and maybe senators ought to be buying mutual funds and other broad-based investments, ETFs, for the sake of their portfolios. But that doesn't mean that they are having any secret information that is allowing them to pick stocks better than the average day trader.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the evidence. And what you just said is an entirely different question, a topic for another day, which is that it turns out that if you look around, very few people, unless they really know their stuff, are in a very good situation or really are in possession of the knowledge you need to really beat the market. And it is why so many Americans, to the extent that they are invested in mutual funds or ETFs, because they just want solid gains. And here's the other thing, too. Not only that evidence that you supplied about the studies that have been done and what we know in general about congressional trading, but to the extent that there is occasionally somebody doing something wrong that they truly shouldn't be doing, we have law enforcement. And, you know, not very long ago, there was a Republican congressional member. He was sentenced to 26 months in prison for engaging in insider trading and then lying to the feds about it. I think my other problem with this as well, too, is just that we do have a remedy for people who view the members that they elected to Congress suspiciously. If you feel like you cannot trust your member, that they are not being honest with you about their own financial investments, if you have news reports or data of your own to somehow back that up, there's these things called elections, and you can throw the bums out. But to overlay on Congress a ban that is not applicable to pretty much any other industry anywhere, I think is unequal treatment and not warranted in this situation.
My final thought on this topic is, again, I understand the criticism of this trading activity. And as Kim points out, it's a political problem for some of these people who were criticized. I mean, Georgia Senator Kelly Loeffler lost her election, and she was harshly criticized for some of this trading activity that, again, she said was made without her knowledge. And so there's also a political reason for senators and representatives to be making these choices, choosing ETFs or mutual funds. But I do worry about the consequences of having a really broad ban on investment activity, and particularly when you start thinking about those 1,200 Senate-confirmed political appointees. Because, Monet, I think we do want people with experience in business, with experience as successful lawyers and successful doctors, pharmaceutical executives, coming into some of these positions and putting their experience to work for the public. And I do worry that if it's just a short-term stint, if they're thinking maybe I'll go work in the FDA for a year or something like that, I think it would be a really huge disincentive if they have to liquidate their portfolios or do some sort of really serious overhaul, putting their things into a blind trust, giving up control of their portfolios that they've spent a lifetime building, maybe divesting from a private company that they've spent a lifetime building. And Monet, I just think that the critics are not really grappling with the trade-offs.
I agree with that. I think of a study that came out maybe 3 or 4 months ago at this point that showed the lack of business experience for your average member of the executive branch. I think it was something like 2.5 years of business experience on average for some of the senior members of the Biden administration. And so that is the risk, you know, the idea that if you make the barriers too high for people who actually come from the private sector to enter politics, then you're just going to have a class of people who have no occupation, no skill set, no knowledge other than policymaking and were sort of incubated in Washington. And so that's a real potential downside. I do think, again, that the goal of making sure that people are not using that time that they are in office to profit is an important one. I don't think that most public servants do that, but I do think that it makes sense to have guardrails in place to make sure that they don't. And I think it's also worth pointing out that there usually are lucrative opportunities on the other end of public service. Obviously, people come into Washington are making extremely important and influential connections and generally building up a Rolodex that is very fruitful to private employers when they come out. And so there is necessarily a financial upside to serving in office in many cases, especially at these very senior levels. But all that being said, we don't want people to say, it's going to be way too much of a hassle for me to leave my private sector job, for me to leave my small business and enter politics. And so that does count as one more strike against the version of the restrictions that the Democrats in the House are now trying to pass.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Another piece of news on this story about President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan and the challenges that are now coming to it. And I'll read just a bit of a CNN report. The Biden administration scaled back eligibility for its student loan forgiveness plan Thursday. And this has to do with federal student loans guaranteed by the government but held by private lenders. And they were initially going to be included, and now they will be not included in this forgiveness program. And Kim, some of the reporting suggests that this is a move that is being done by the Biden administration specifically because they are worried that these private financial institutions that hold these loans will sue. And I mean, am I wrong in reading this as a bit of a tacit admission that the Biden administration understands that what they're doing here is not lawful?
Oh, yeah, you're reading that exactly right. And they're worried not just that they're going to get a lawsuit from some of these private lenders, but they're worried about a lawsuit that was already filed this week by those six state attorney generals in Republican states. And they potentially have a claim here, too, in that one of the arguments they make in the suit is that their injury comes via the fact that their states, or at least some of them, have these quasi-state entities that technically kind of count as private institutions that are servicing these loans, and that if the Biden administration forgives them, their states will lose money. And so there was a suggestion, I think is a very strong indication, that this move by the Biden administration was both to try to make moot that lawsuit and also to ward off anything from a private lender or loan servicer. Now, I don't think it is going to save them from the state lawsuit because they make arguments about other ways that they are injured financially via this move. But this seems like a pretty cynical attempt by DOE, Department of Education, to get out of their legal travails.
But Monet, this is a fascinating move for them to change the program after the fact to try to avoid another lawsuit. And I am finding myself wondering whether this is a fact that some of these other plaintiffs are going to be citing when they finally get to court. I mean, they may point to this move and say, look, obviously the Biden administration is trying to avoid the lawsuits, and that's its whole legal plan. It knows that it doesn't have the authority unilaterally to forgive this kind of money.
Right. I mean, in as much as a guilty mind is a requirement for a successful prosecution, there seems to be no guiltier possible mind than the one the Biden administration has brought to its student loan maneuver. Obviously, he said himself as a candidate that he didn't think it was possible. Many other Democrats have said the same. And so you have this kind of retroactive legal maneuvering to try to shore it up now that they believe that it's politically popular and have made it part of their midterm push. I think it'll be interesting to see how the lawsuits pan out. Challenges are probably going to continue coming. It does seem like the sort of thing that courts usually shy away from restricting. Generally, they don't want to interfere on what the president claims is kind of a large policy prerogative of this kind. And so I think that even though the legal arguments seem to lack a lot of merit, it's something where you could see some judicial restraint. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some kind of compromise, if there was a court order that the manner of the policy be kind of curtailed somewhat. But I do think that just the fundamental question about whether the Biden administration believes in their heart that their policy on student loans is legal, there's a very, very clear answer, and the answer is no.
Well, let's do a couple more letters because I've said it before, but I still think the Biden administration is underrating the political effect that this issue may have. And we have two letters here from listeners who served in the military. And let's start with Scott. He says, am I the only one who's responded to the college loan forgiveness by stopping my automatic deposits into my grandchildren's 529 accounts? I'll continue to save, but a 529 plan seems much less appealing given the uncertainty of the government's relationship to college financing. By the way, I spent 10 years in the U.S. Army Reserve to pay for my children's education. I do not regret my time of service, but I do feel somewhat taken advantage of. And that is echoed by Andrew, who says, if we're going to use service to one's country, during which one writes a blank check to the government, allowing it to put them in harm's way and potentially die, as the gold standard for having one's tuition paid for under the GI Bill, then any income-based repayment followed by forgiveness or this recent Biden boondoggle can only be looked at as a disgrace. He says that forgiving loans to those who made no sacrifice and instead enjoyed green campuses, inflated tuition, and marginally useful classes lacks accountability and decency. Monet, my last thought here is, again, I mean, most of the country does not have a college degree. And I think this is an issue that will play not only with Republicans, conservatives, people who are opposed to the Biden administration anyway, but a lot of people in the Democratic coalition or who used to be in the Democratic coalition, maybe people that were once considered Reagan Democrats, will be upset by this. And the higher that this issue rises as we get toward the November elections, the better I think it is for the Republican Party, who is probably promising that it will sue if they take the House of Representatives.
Yeah, I sympathize with both of those letter writers. And I do think it's just fascinating to think about the political calculation that the Democrats made when they decided to move forward on the student loan forgiveness. I think that when they first floated the idea, they got a bigger backlash than they anticipated. And so they curtailed the scale a little bit. Obviously, they're not forgiving sort of the full loan amount. They've capped it. But still, this is one of those types of policies that benefits a very small and frankly, relatively affluent group of people in a way that's just bound to make everyone else feel that they're being treated unfairly. And so you do see this now and then in politics. You know, you have political constituency that holds a lot of sway with the party in power, and the party in power decides we're going to pass this policy that benefits you and so just kind of pay them off. I would assume that what President Biden and the people in his inner circle think is that all of the people who didn't get loan forgiveness are going to forget about it. You know, they're angry now. They got angry when they read the headlines about the policy, but they'll move on. You know, life goes on. Whereas the people who did get student loan forgiveness are never going to forget, and they're always going to be loyal to the Democrats. But frankly, I think based on the response we've seen so far, that might be a miscalculation. And there are a lot of people who are going to be very angry about it, who certainly are going to vote based on that this November. And maybe it will be a rift between the two parties that's going to have a lot of people second guessing their support for Democrats moving forward.
Thank you, Monet and Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. Wall Street Journal members can also join Paul Jugot, Kimberly Strassel, and Karl Rove for a live opinion event, Can Republicans Retake Congress?, on Monday, October 17th at 7 p.m. That will be in Dallas or streamed online. And for more information, go to wsjplus.com/opinionlive for tickets and more information. And as always, we'll be back here next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost-effective, Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed, and Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.